But first, Lewis Hyde. Hyde is a MacArthur Fellow, a creative writing professor, and the author of the modern classic, The Gift. His new book is called Common as Air: Revolution, Art, and Ownership. It offers a defense of our cultural commons, the vast store of art and ideas we've inherited from the past and which continue to enrich our present. As he told Steve Paulson, Hyde is skeptical of the entertainment industry's argument that intellectual property is no different from physical property.
Well, it's false. The typical analogy they offer is that stealing a song on the internet is the same as stealing shoes from a shoe store or a physical book from a bookstore. The problem is that this erases one of the very important distinctions that we've been wrestling with for thousands of years, and particularly for the last 300 years, which is that art and ideas that are not embodied, that is a song, a mythology, the idea about how to make bifocal glasses, the Pythagorean theorem, Shakespeare's play, all these things are what economists call non-rival. That is to say, if you have them and I have them and somebody else wants them, we can give them to the third person without anybody losing anything. Famous line of Thomas Jefferson's. He says, ideas are like the fire of a flame, that if you light your candle from mine, it doesn't put my candle out. It just spreads the flame. So there's an important distinction between things that we do own but nonetheless have no physical presence and things we own which do have a physical presence. And part of the problem for the last 300 years has been to figure out how then to think about these incorporeal things like a novel, a poem, a song, and how to organize and imagine the ownership of them.
Are you saying we just need to throw out the whole idea of intellectual property?
No, I think it's a useful idea. Well, what we do now is have a regime called copyright and one called patent, which allows people to own created things. And I think these are useful tools. But one needs to understand that these are tools actually designed to deal with the fact that art and ideas are different in kind from shoes and physical books. And secondly, to come to a second distinction, once we're in this realm of things that happen in the mind, we're also in the realm of expression. So to give somebody ownership rights in that realm can also be thought of as giving them the right to suppress expression, to control art and ideas. And now we begin to think, well, maybe there's some reasons to limit people's ability to express, to suppress what other people want to express.
Now, another point that the entertainment industry has tried to put forward is that copyright infringement is the same as plagiarism. Again, you don't agree.
Well, they aren't the same. And I mean, what's puzzling is why their curricula simplify and, in a sense, stupefy these useful distinctions. Plagiarism means using somebody's work without acknowledging that it belongs to somebody else. You can plagiarize from Shakespeare, and there's no copyright infringement because copyright doesn't exist in Shakespeare's work. Similarly, you can infringe a copyright without plagiarizing. Copyright infringement is against the law. It's about legal rules. Plagiarism is typically an ethical violation in certain communities, but actually not in all communities. There are some, and in the book I talk, for example, about the community of law, where lawyers and judges regularly take from each other's work without attribution because the law is considered to be public discourse. Nobody owns it. And therefore, the rules of borrowing are different in legal discourse than they are, for example, in the academy. So plagiarism is, in some communities, an ethical violation. Copyright infringement is a matter of law.
Now, I think the way this would usually be thought of, let's take Shakespeare as an example. You quote some lines from Shakespeare to make a point or you to incorporate into your own artistic work, and the reference to Shakespeare is clear. You know, it's not as if you're really ripping him off, but you're using him for your own artistic efforts, and that is quite different than lifting passages of a book that maybe no one knows about and then trying to pass it off as your own.
Right. That would be plagiarism. You know, all creativity builds on the world around it and what has come before. Everybody understands this in all realms, in science, in literature, in painting. You know, one knows what has happened in the past and it's in your mind. Famously, Sir Isaac Newton said that he had stood on the shoulders of giants. Perhaps he had seen further, but he couldn't have seen as far as he did if there hadn't been scientists who came before him. So this business of borrowing is part of the creative process, no matter what world you're in.
And you devote a whole chapter in your book to Benjamin Franklin, which is interesting because the common thinking is that Franklin was the quintessential self-made man, this guy who went off and sort of dreamed up all these amazing inventions on his own, but you're saying the real story is more complicated.
Well, Franklin is a wonderful character, and he is, of course, was a genius, and few people are like him. But when you look closely at the way Franklin worked, you see that partly his genius was what I think of as the genius of a host, in the sense that he worked collaboratively with many other people, and also he read incredibly widely. So that, for example, Franklin is credited with some important discoveries in the theory of how electricity works. If you understand how Franklin came to them, you see that what he was doing was reading books that came out of England and France and Germany, corresponding with people on the continent, working with three friends in Philadelphia. He was working in a community, and he understood that he was working in a community and that he had obligations to that community too. So Franklin never took a patent on any of his inventions and said he intentionally did not do so because he felt indebted to the past. And he never took a copyright on any of his writings. The main point being that he felt that if you want to have a creative community, such as he had in the scientific world, you need low barriers to the circulation of knowledge.
Well, not only did he not claim legal ownership of some of his inventions, he didn't even publicize this, I mean, which is striking because he was a publisher himself. I mean, he did not, I mean, for instance, in Poor Richard's Almanac, he published instructions on how to make a lightning rod, but he didn't mention that he was the inventor.
Yeah, you know, one interesting thing is at this period we have a shift out of what's called guild secrecy into public knowledge. And so for centuries, guilds, you know, people who know, for example, how to make swords out of steel would keep secret their knowledge. And what happens in the 18th century is people begin to think, no, it's much better to have knowledge released to the world. And Franklin is right on the cusp of this. And in fact, part of the structure of our patent law, even now, is you get to have your monopoly privilege for a short time in exchange for explaining to the whole world how you did it clearly enough that anybody else could do it as soon as it's released to the public domain. And so Franklin actually follows this without even taking a patent. That is to say, when he invents the lightning rod, he immediately publishes a full description of how to do it in Poor Richard's Almanac, doesn't sign his name. I mean, people would have assumed that it was Franklin, but the point for him was to disseminate knowledge, not to own it.
Well, you can't really imagine that happening today, can you? Let me push you on this a little bit, because it sounds like you're suggesting that if we lose our sense of a cultural commons, then we slip into tyranny on the artistic front. We lose our creativity because we're not allowed to borrow from cultural products that came before us. How far are you willing to go here?
I believe both those things are true, maybe in simpler senses than the words immediately call up. In the book, I borrow a thing from Pascal, who has an interesting definition of tyranny. He says, you know, the world is a complicated place. We have different realms of social practice and different norms in different realms. For example, the church is one world and your family is one and the marketplace is one and the army is one, colleges are one and so forth. And rightly so, these different worlds might have different norms about how to behave. And he says what becomes tyrannous is when one realm begins to dominate the others or invade them and suppress them. So, for example, we think about a plutocracy as a place where people who have money get to dominate everything else. Or an aristocracy is where people who have family connections get to decide what happens in the marketplace. And it's a useful way to think about complex social systems. So an example now of a place where we have a tension like this is the entertainment industry interested in controlling how knowledge circulates on college campuses. Now, clearly, they have an interest in students downloading music that they don't own, and that's appropriate. But what they would like to do is to get into the college campuses and control the way the computer networks work. And that begins to invade a different economy and a different set of knowledge norms because colleges and universities are more set up on a gift exchange basis in which ideas and data travel freely in a community of scholars.
Explain how this would work. How are they trying to control computer networks on college campuses?
You know, I reproduce a letter from the guy who's in charge of the computers at MIT. And what the industry would like to do is have Congress force MIT and other colleges to put filters on the networks, which would try to figure out who's sending what. And the MIT tech person says, essentially, You know, you can't put filters on our networks and still have us do the kind of science that we currently do. So filtering the college computer network would be one way of trying to impose an entertainment industry sense of the rules on a academic community's different sense of the rules.
But this is a real tension because, on the one hand, you certainly can see the frustration of professors who want to, let's say, copy a chapter from a book so they can teach it in a class and, you know, without having to go through all the permissions to be able to do that, without having to pay for it, because, you know, they're constantly doing this, bringing in material to their classes. And yet, on the other hand, you can see why the people who actually wrote those chapters want to get paid for their work.
Yeah, absolutely. And my book is not an anti-copyright book. I think copyright is a very useful tool. My book itself is copyrighted. I get a piece of my income from royalties. The question is, well, you say it's attention. That's right. The question is how to find the balance. To take the example you just gave, one way that in this country that we've tried to adjudicate the balance in college campuses is, on the one hand, we have copyright. People own their work. On the other hand, we have what's called the Fair Use Statute, which allows people to use copyrighted work without asking permission, without paying fees. Fair use is supposed to square the monopoly control of copyright with the First Amendment, which allows us to speak freely. And so you and I can quote something from a book on this radio show because we have the Fair Use Statute. We don't need to get permission. The Fair Use Statute actually singles out education as a special case. It says that professors can make multiple copies for classroom use of something. There are a bunch of different carve-outs for educational use that make it easy to teach and not burden the students with monetary impediments to their own learning.
And my sense is that you really don't want to reduce this to a legal case. I mean, you're not a lawyer yourself. You obviously are familiar with the law, but you're talking about something at a larger cultural level, a societal level.
The project of my book is to try to enlarge the set of narratives that will help us think through the puzzle of cultural ownership given digital copying and the internet and so forth. And I think the entertainment industry story is a useful one to have and makes sense in some situations. But when you look at the founders, you find at least three other stories. You're right. My agenda here is more philosophical than practical. The practical would come out of getting the philosophy right. And philosophically, the three other stories are, one is about democracy, one is about creative communities, and the other one is about public personhood. How do you become an actor politically or culturally, you know, who operates in a social system as opposed to in a private individualist way?
Lewis Hyde is the author of Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership. He spoke with Steve Paulson.